or rhetorical exercises for the grammar school age, then you're in the right place. If not, you need to make a dash, because it'll be a long hour for you. Not too long, hopefully. My name is Scott Smith, and I teach fourth grade at Westminster Academy in Memphis, Tennessee. In doing this workshop, I kind of have to fire a lot of bullets in your direction and hope that I hit with a few. I realize that if you just take home a couple things or take a few things back to your school that will lead you in the right direction, then I feel I will have felt successful in my presentation. I've been to a lot of workshops over the years, and I realize there's this tendency to be overwhelmed and burned out by the amount of material, and it seems like every teacher has got it together so much better than you do. I just hope you take a few things when you go back, and I'm still working through some of these things, still fleshing out the philosophy of this classical education, and then just practically seeing how that works in a classroom. Something that's really freed me up is to remember that the principle of Christian education really is that disciples will be like their master. To put it another way, the teacher is the lesson. Now, that doesn't mean we don't have any curricular materials or we don't do anything but sit around and chat all day. But just remember, you're the lesson, and they're going to learn from you, and let your personality. One famous Christian preacher has said, preaching is a truth mediated through personality. So allow the truth of your particular class level or your subject to be permeated by your personality. And that will be the blessing to your children. Why don't we go ahead and have a word of prayer, and then we'll get started. Father, we thank you that you have brought each one of us here safely. We thank you for another opportunity just to rest from our labors, to take a break, to reflect and think about our vocation as teachers and administrators. We thank you, Father, that we can come together in a conference and we can glean so much knowledge from people with a variety of backgrounds and experiences. We see your goodness in this and we give you praise for it. And I pray now that as we step into this workshop on the Progymnasmata, that you would bless each one of us and give us something to take back to our schools, something encouraging, clear vision for our education, something practical to use in the classroom. We ask in Jesus' name, amen. Once upon a time in a faraway land, there was a school put together by a community of bears, and it was called Ursine Academy. They were well-intentioned bears, and they had some novel ideas for the education of their little bears. They put the school together and they had a basic approach to the education, but at times there was a little bit of confusion as to the exact philosophy and the practice of the Ursine Academy. Well, as the years went by, there seemed to be a noticeable problem with the first stage of the education, which consisted of three stages. And later on, somebody realized that in the beginning, perhaps that first stage was not real clear in the minds of the bear educators, consisting of parents of bear students as well as nice single folks who like children. Well, somewhere along the line, when the little bears got to the second level of the Ursine Trivium, they were supposed to start to think a little bit with this thing called logic or the dialectic stage. And that should have been a wonderful, light, airy feather to the little bear students. Instead, it became a back-breaking burden that they carried around on a daily basis. So they trudged through that stage, burden on back and all, and then made it to the last stage, the queen of the education, the rhetoric or the Ursine rhetorical stage, the poetical stage. This should have been a beautiful, attractive, goddess-like figure to them. Instead, it was a horrible, ugly, black witch riding a broom. Well, somebody finally figured out that in the first stages of the Ursine education, they'd been told that it only consisted in the memorization of facts. And that somehow, when they got to these next stages, they'd be able to use their minds and their hearts and their tongues and their pens and pencils to communicate wonderful, truthful things. Instead, they fell completely short of the task. So, a little bit of rethinking. The Bears got together in a committee meeting. And they said, well, now what are we trying to produce at the end of this Ursine education? And maybe we need to backtrack and figure out what happened at the early stages of the education. And so they got together and they figured out that there was a great problem with the early stages of the education, that it really didn't help them achieve the goals of the education. Well, that's my little story, my little fable, the Ursine Academy. As I begin, that may have registered with some of you. Some of you may have thought, what in the world is this guy talking about? If you're a classical educator, you think a lot about the philosophy of the education, and you need to. That's part of it. And you may not realize it, but your philosophy, your theology, the principles that you've embraced, the grid that you look at life through, determines everything you do. It determines your practice. And so if you think the grammar stage is simply the memorization of facts, and that's going to help with the rest of this education, I think you've only got a part of what the trivium is all about. And so I'm thinking through some of these things myself, our school is, and I encourage you to do so as well. How many of you, just with a little show of hands, would say, if someone said, what's classical education? You said, oh, it consists of this thing called the trivium, the three ways, the trivium, and it's grammar, logic, and rhetoric. And they said, great, well, that doesn't mean anything to me. What do you teach? Well, I teach in the grammar. Well, what do you guys do? And then you said, well, what was the classical education? How many of you said, well, in the early stages, we memorize a lot of facts. We try to learn the facts of a lot of subjects that we have. How many of you would say something like that? I would have, for sure. That would have been my simple answer. And then you ask, well, how does that fit with the goal of rhetoric, of actually being able to communicate persuasively, to speak the truth in love, but to speak in a way that shows that you're using your mind and to persuade people? How is the memorization of facts going to get you there? And what I'm finding happening as I speak with upper school teachers is you can over-memorize factism, the grammar stage, and when kids get to the logic stage and the rhetoric stage, all they want is to get more facts. Whereas when they get into history, when they get older, they should be integrating theology and thinking through these great historical events. Instead, they say, could you just give us the dates? Could you just give us the geographical facts? Could you just tell us what names to know? And they don't really want to think through. Well, we're kind of at fault for that. And I think maybe we're missing some of the main points of the education. I would say that the trivium is actually an art. It's imparting an art, and that art consists in verbal skills. That's really what the trivium is trying to accomplish. That's why the queen of the stage, if you will, is rhetoric or communication in writing and verbally. That's where we're moving with it. And the trivium, classical education, is an art. Now, the problem we have in our society, we're very scientific. We're very objective, analytical. You know, this in, that out, it's all predictable. You know, the whole preoccupation with the grading system and, you know, what makes a paper a 92 versus a 93 and all that kind of stuff where, you know, we take the objective approach to a soccer match where if, you know, one team puts two balls in the goal, the other team puts one in, the first team won. You know, my kids will tell me about their little sporting events and say, well, we should have won. I'll say, no, you should not have won. You didn't win. 2-1. Easy, black and white. Education's not quite like that. And if you are an artistic person, you're either engaged in studies in the visual arts. I'm a musician, trained in classical music and jazz. and have played music a lot of years, spent a lot of time, hopefully fairly competent on the instrument. But the approach to an art is very different than a scientific skill. And it's really what Christian discipleship is. It's the idea of not just giving people facts and having them regurgitate them, or some of my kids say in my class, is this barf back mode, Mr. Smith? You know, we just giving this stuff back to you? Yes, you're right. We do have to do some of that. But Christian education, what Christ set up, is the apprentice model where, I mean, you're literally taking the child's hand, and you know, you're putting your hands over his and walking through him, speaking the words through him. It's imitation. We remember that our God is a verbal God. He's a God that speaks. He's not a silent, mean, angry God who's just waiting to blow up at us. You know, the gospel undid of all that thinking that comes from the garden, the horticultural disaster that affects all of humanity. And so the gospel undoes that. God is a speaking God. He communicates. It's interesting, too, if you just ever study the Bible, it's not full of propositional facts like we teach our kids a lot of times. It's full of metaphor and analogy. And it's interesting that, you know, you won't find a word like omnipotent in the Bible. You know, David doesn't start off a psalm and say, "Oh God, thou art omnipotent." You know, he uses these metaphors, these analogies, these word pictures. You're a rock. You're a tower of refuge. And the mind immediately, you know, gets the picture. You know, the whole thing. That's the way God communicates. And then the Bible is a story. It's the story of redemption. And Christ was the parabolic master unwielding these great kingdom truths and stories. We have poetry in Scripture, beautiful prose. We've got analytical forensic writing a la the Apostle Paul. I mean, wonderful. I mean, just from a literary perspective, the Bible's incredible. We've got all of that, and yet, you know, we tend to reduce the education just to facts and so forth. So what I'm saying is we're trying to impart the skill of the verbal arts. That's what we're after in the classical education. How many have ever even heard of the word progymnasmata? You've heard of that word. So it's kind of getting around for a while. I remember several years ago when our school was introduced to this, and we have kind of one of the masters of rhetoric at our school. I mean, he has stacks of rhetoric books on his nightstand. I mean, he's just kind of one of those guys. And we asked him, well, just boil this down to us. You know, just give us something, you know, that we can use. And he's done a really good job at doing that. But the first topic of debate was, number one, you know, how do you spell this word? I mean, how many syllables is it? We didn't know where to put the accent. I mean, we used to come in and we'd say, okay, today is it going to be progymnasmata? Or is it going to be progymnasmata? Or progymnasmata? I mean, it was just, you know, we kind of kidded about it. You know, five-syllable word. It comes from the Greek word gymnazo, which you may be familiar with in one of Paul's letters to Timothy, where he said, train yourself for godliness, where we get our word gymnasium. And the pro gymnasmata, that's the correct pronunciation. Everybody say it. Progymnasmata. Yeah, put the accent on the right place. They are the first or primary exercises in the verbal arts. And so all the way back to the 4th century B.C., Greece, and so forth, these have been used in classical, medieval, early patristics, medieval, Renaissance education. And basically, the masters of rhetoric viewed the pro-gym, which we affectionately call it, as it's a lot easier to say, pro-gym. You know, maybe somebody can come up with some kind of acronym, you know, PGNM or something, you know, really conciliar sounding. And so they've used this method of education, and the teachers of rhetoric would use this as the first exercise. Of course, that might have been a young student, or it might have been an older student who hadn't been educated. I'm just sort of thinking what could have happened, where they would always start them with these first exercises. Now, the progym is artistic. I do teach some guitar on the side, and I like to teach, and some of you may have children that take music lessons. Well, it's interesting when you think about how you teach an art like music. You know, we don't hand the child, you know, in his first few lessons, a sheet of music with all of these you know, markings on there and all of that vast language there and just say, okay, we're going to learn how to read this, and you're not going to play anything until you can read all of the nuances of this musical chart that I've set before you. I mean, you wouldn't do that. You'd say, that's crazy. You would combine it with listening and then gradually taking from the imitative art where you play a little melody and then they play the melody back and then you start to show them, well, that note's called this and so forth. Can you imagine the first time you put Mary Had a Little Lamb up there and you start, you know, using all this harmonic language? Now, it starts on the third and then it descends in a pattern to the second and then the root, and then we move up here and then it's harmonized like this, and then it moves from the tonic to the subtonic, back to the tonic, and then to the subtonic. I mean, the kid was like, what are you talking about? I mean, this is crazy. And sometimes that's how we educate. Or we, you know, and then we start chanting, you know, let's say this, tonic, subdominant, dominant, you know, and you're like, I don't know, what is this stuff? This is torture. And so you sit down and you say, well, let's listen to some music. And let's follow this along. And now here's this piece here. Let's listen to this player do it. And then let's listen to this player do it. And then let's analyze, you know, what they're doing. And then gradually, through steps, right, you take them, because ultimately what you want them to do is be able to play a piece of music that actually moves the people, that communicates something beautiful and good to the listener. Well, that's kind of like what the pro gym is like. And so there's a lot of kind of rethinking with the pro gym. All right, one last thing too in the first little section there that says trivium, just kind of introductory stuff about the quadrivium, the next stage of this education, if you hadn't been filled in already. It doesn't end with just the trivium. I mean, all the trivium does is provide the tools of education. You might have heard that before. The tool is skill in the verbal arts. So you can move on to the quadrivium, a broad liberal arts education where you actually move into the mathematical sciences. Study arithmetic, music, which is very mathematical, and so forth. You move to that next stage. And then after you've kind of done all of that, the quadrivium, you know, like we've got seven stages at this point. Trivium, quadrivium. Then you're ready for science, theology, philosophy, you know, all the really good stuff out there. So, I mean, the education is really broad. And so the thing is called the grammar stage because we're talking about language, about verbal things. You know, we kind of said, you know, when people say, why do you call it the grammar stage? Is it all just about, you know, learning Latin grammar or something? Like, oh, no, I don't know. It's just kind of like grammar, sort of like the building blocks of language. And so we're just doing the building blocks in the lower school. Well, that's not really it. They were teaching them linguistically. All right. With the pro gym, as we move on, Roman numeral 2, this whole idea of teaching oral and written communication skills, I really struggled with how do you teach somebody to write? And we kind of have this, and it's because I was not thinking artistically, I was thinking scientifically. I was thinking like a math, you know, long division, you know, like, well, here's the concept of division, and now, you know, you do this, you put this number over here, multiply this number, subtract this number, put that number down, bring this number down, and then you start the whole process again, you know, step. Well, how do I, you know, what do I do with writing? It's like, well, I don't really know what to do. I guess, you know, people use this kind of evolutionary language. Well, you're either born a writer or you're not, you know, you're not a writer. You can't make a writer. You're either born a vocalist, a musician, you know, you either got it or you don't. Well, that's encouraging. So, I mean, so what's the point? Do we have like some kind of objective test that we can apply in the hospital before the kids come home? Okay, this is, you know, this is a writer here. You know, and you just put the W on the head or something. The Scarlet W. Anyways, so I really struggled with, you know, kind of putting this whole thing together. And the pro gym, to me, rather than just being another subject, you know, it's like, oh, gee, here we go. He's going to sell me on this thing, and now I've got math, Latin, history, literature, and this thing I can't even say. And the kids don't even know what it is, right? So, you know, you kind of put it on the back shelf and all that. You know, this is something that pervades your education in the lower school. That's if you get that point, this is something that will help you bring your education to actually where it should be going if we're going to achieve the goal of skill in the verbal arts upon the completion of the trivium. Letter B there in number 2, imitation versus creativity. It's interesting. We've got this little propensity to imitate. Can be a good thing. Can be a bad thing. If you're a parent, you know, you hate to say something like, you know, when your child comes in and utters this thing that's usually, you know, asterisks and exclamation points and all that, you know, and you're kind of like, you know, where did you learn that? You know, and what's the first question? Who have you been around? You know, maybe they were just out playing a few minutes in what I call, affectionately where I live, the hood. They were out in the hood, and of course, some bad pagan kid came over and, you know, just, you know, messed your whole thing up, and here's this expletive deletive that's come into his vocabulary. And, you know, so, but you don't really want to do that if your theology is good, because you know he's your child, your son or daughter, is not basically good. You know, I usually, when that stuff happens, I was like, okay, so what did mine do? You know, what circle is he, you know, starting out there behind my back? You know, I mean, he comes from the womb speaking lies, you know, a little serpent kind of kid. So it's this imitation thing, though. And so whereas you don't like to say, you know, who have you been hanging around, because they're going to imitate it. My son got in this little spat, and he's in sports camp this week, and he called this kid something. And, you know, I kind of laughed because this neighborhood kid had called me that when he was mad at me when I told him to go home one day. He kind of mumbled away and said, and he called me something. And then my son, you know, my son was in this sports game, and then he got mad at this child, and he called this child the same thing. And they don't even know what it is. You know, that's what's interesting. But anyways, this imitation thing. And now here's what we do with this creativity with writing or communication. Why don't you sit down, Johnny, and write a story? Okay, now you got some of them where you're going to have to hold them back, right? I mean, they're going to be there. I mean, you're just like, okay, can it, you know, stop, put a period on it, end the thing, you know, done, finny, all that kind of stuff. And then you got other ones that are going to sit there, and actually probably most of them. And then you come over, you know, after 10, 15 minutes, after, you know, Johnny has told you this, you know, epic story that he's putting together, and then you come over and say, do you have a problem? I can't think of anything to write. Well, they're little imitators. You know, it's like sitting down here. Here's a violin. Here's a bow. Here's a string. Put it up here. Here's your assignment for this week. Practice 15 minutes a day. Write something. Compose something for next week. You know? You know, squawk, 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 squawk. I mean, they just don't know anything. It's interesting. I was camping out in the backyard a couple weeks ago with my 4-year-old daughter and my 9-year-old son, and we were kind of sitting around, and I read some stories to them, and then I said, well, let's tell some stories here. Tara Grace, why don't you go ahead and start? I can't think of anything. Salem, why don't you go ahead? Can't think of anything. So I went, okay. So I just took one of these fables and I just, you know, completely wigged the thing out and just kind of got the wheels going. And then they just started imitating things. It kind of, you know, it's sort of a copycat thing. So the whole thing with the Pro Gym is that it's actually going to give the kids something that they can write about. It's not just going to be this sort of creative kind of get out of what's inside of you writing. It's going to give them something that they can do. It's like music lessons. We're going to learn some scales. We're going to learn some music theory. We're going to learn some harmony. We're going to learn some chords. We're going to read this. And you kind of put it all together. And then finally they can play a piece of music. The Pro Gym is a proven approach. If you've ever read older writings and you wonder, how do guys write like that? I mean, were they just born with that? Well, they were actually trained in these rhetorical skills. And so they could pick any topic and debate for it, debate against it, and weave it out, and, you know, the person listening to it would be really convinced. Of course, that's always the danger of rhetoric, because today rhetoric's kind of, you know, a bad word, because it can be used for evil things, because it's persuasion. If you've ever read Gorgias, you know, that's the whole ethical question. You know, like, what is rhetoric? I mean, what are you doing with this thing? I mean, I can see if you're teaching, you know, math, you're actually imparting something, but what is rhetoric? What is a teacher of rhetoric actually doing? And so they have this whole ethical question, and the argument keeps coming back, well, you can use it for evil. And he said, well, that's not really the point. It's the package. You take truth and you package it with the rhetorical skills. That's what the rhetoric is for. All right. The 14 steps. Now, when I explain the Pro Gym to my kids, if you just started, I go and I write that big word on the board, and we kind of kid about it, and we'll call it Pro Gym. And if you want to kind of be real educational, institutional, you can call it, you know, composition or something like that. You know, go with this great big Greek classical word, teach it to them, and all that kind of stuff. And then I put a little ladder or a little staircase, and I mention this is what it is. They're just these gradually increasing steps towards rhetorical skills, the ability to speak and write, and they get more difficult as they go along. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you these 14 steps, and some of you overachievers are going to try to write all these down and think you need to know and understand all of these steps. That's a great thing, but I'm going to go so fast that you can't do it. Because at the grammar stage, we're not going to deal with all 14 steps. I mean, after we get to about 5, you're going to be thinking, yeah, right, as if a senior could do some of this stuff in the typical school. But what I want to do is give you a big picture of what the Pro Gym consists of. And this was the whole point in the training in rhetoric, was to be able to defend a law. So you think of like a Greek city-state where, you know, all the men got together and somebody's going to say, you know, we need to do this or stop doing this or make some legislation so nobody else does it. And if they do it, they get a, you know, punishment and all that kind of stuff. And if they break the law. And that was the point, that they could persuade people. And that was the goal. So you're thinking, now your kids are not going to sit down and, well, the sense of justice would probably warrant, you know, they're wanting to make laws, particularly for their fellow classmates. But we're not going to go there. Let me just give you the steps. I'll give you slowly the first 4, because those are actually, I think, the ones that will apply up to about 6th grade. Now, kids in 11th grade who are getting on to the high-level rhetoric with common topics and theses and all that kind of stuff, I mean, it's hard to even remember the terms. You know, they'll still do some of these elementary exercises. It's part of, it's kind of like, you know, somebody that can play the most complex classical piece on violin still has to practice scales. And that person will, every time they practice the scales, there will be something new and fresh that will come going back to those elementary exercises. Okay, the first one is just, and I'm just going to give these to you, the first 4 I'll give a brief description, then kind of move quickly through these other ones so you can see what they are. The first one is fable. It's called fable. The retelling, basically the paraphrasing of Aesop's fables or other little basic elementary stories. Step 2 moves into what we call the fairy tale or the narrative. One step beyond the fable. It's a little bit more complex story. You think of Grimm's fairy tales of Hans Christian Andersen. I mean, there are just tales and stories and narratives galore. I mean, I have books where I just, you know, am messing around on the internet and I come across these tremendous stories. I've discovered the rewritten fairy tales of Andrew Lang. If anybody's ever read Lang, he influenced, I think, Roger Lancelin Green, was the guy that does the King Arthur and Robin Hood rewrites. And basically, these guys were brilliant men who just found such pleasure in retelling these ancient stories that they wrote these books, and they're tremendous. I mean, there are stories everywhere. I mean, of course, literature is just the study of an extended story. A Bible class, again, the study and analysis of an extended story. So fable, step 2, fairy tale narrative, step 3, what we call kreia or anecdote. And that's just a spelling test. We'll see how good you do with it. Kreia or anecdote. These are just little short, wise sayings that usually come from a historical narrative. Perhaps you're telling the story of Augustine's conversion when he's wrestling with his internal sin and so forth, and here's supposedly the little kid singing that little Latin song, tole lege, take up and read, take up and read, that little anecdote there, that little nursery rhyme kind of thing. Well, you could sort of retell the story of Augustine built around that little phrase there. Or perhaps something Luther, you know, he talked about dealing with temptation, and he used that little anecdote or quote, you can keep the birds from flying over your head, but you can't keep the birds from flying over your head, but you can keep them from building nests in your hair. You're basically saying, you know, the birds are like temptation. Temptation is going to be around. Nothing you can do about that. But you can keep them from building nests in your hair. So, you know, the child would maybe retell a little incident with Luther struggling with sin and then incorporate that little anecdote. Step 4 is the proverb. And we'll look in a little more detail, kind of in the fable, fairy tale narrative, which I couple these two together. One and two are real similar, and then three and four. The kreia, or anecdote, and then the proverb. And basically what the child would be doing at that stage would take a proverb. Of course, you got Bible proverbs or other wise saying, birds of a feather flock together, stuff like that. They would kind of amplify on this and illustrate that proverb with a story. Of course, they need to retell stories. That's why you focus on one and two. Then when you get to the level where they actually understand a basic proverb, which I think even young children can do that, I find it takes a little bit of logic at this stage to do this, where they're given the proverb, and then they run through a couple of literary steps, tell what the proverb says, and then illustrate the proverb. I remember my class memorizes one proverb a week, and I kind of use that for this. You know, they don't realize that I'm just giving them all these tools. And they all like, you know, pride goes before destruction, haughty spirit before a fall. You know, that's used out on the kickball field, you know, when someone was bragging and then they, you know, scrape their body on the pavement when they trip over somebody, you know, and they're like, you know, Proverbs 16:18, you know, pride, you're proud, and all that kind of stuff. So that's a great one. I remember a guy writing this little story, and he's my little preacher, and he wrote, pride going down, down, down. And it was great. And then actually what you can do at the end of the proverb, after you run through this little stage and then kind of illustrate it with a story. Now, of course, it could be the story of the kickball game. It could be a story from history. It could be one of Aesop's fables, which, you know, that's how you kind of couple these things back in together, or fairy tale. And he retells this story. And then he just would start preaching, you know, so my friend, don't be proud. Resist all temptation. Follow the human. You know, he's like just preaching this stuff. Anyways, the kids are retelling this thing one week. And he gets up and he said, do you mind if it goes a little bit longer? Because I usually like about 5 minutes when the kids actually get up and do this for a grade, whatever that might be. And he said, it's going to be a little bit longer than usual. I said, okay, well, this was last year. And he had read the stuff by Tolkien. And he basically, extemporaneously, no notes, no anything, retold the story of the Lord of the Rings. And then when he got to the end with Gollum, he said, and what we do with these fables, they tell the fable or something, and then they give the little moral there. And he tells this whole thing, and then he said, pride goes before destruction, haughty spirit before fall. He sits down. We're all kind of sitting there with our mouths open. I'm glad I know you, because one day you're going to do great things. All right, those are the first four. Now I'm going to move quickly through. Now again, what you're trying to do with these are verbal arts, skill in communication and so forth. So these are the beginning stages that we're going to focus on. Now I move through, and you'll see how this thing kind of makes sense. The goal at the end is that you can stand up and defend a law. Say, we should have this law, and then you can go through and draw from historical, literary sources, ethical illustrations, and all of that kind of stuff to move the legislative body to pass this law that you proposed. All right, number five is what you call refutation. And that's when you would disprove one of the points. So you refute it, refutation. Six, confirmation. You prove a point of the narrative. And I couple five and six together, refuting and confirming things. If you read the Puritans, they're great at doing this. And of course, they were really skilled in these exercises. They would come through and they would offer these opposing views, and they would refute them. And then they would confirm the interpretation that they were purporting from their exegesis. So refutation, confirmation, you prove the point of the narrative. Then seven, this one just kind of sticks in here. It's called commonplace. And that's when you actually talk about general moral qualities. They get into this in higher level of rhetoric, where they have to do a paper on ethics, variety of things. Moral qualities, patience, goodness, truth, justice. I always like with my kids, you know, with the definition of words, they'll say, Mr. Smith, that's not fair. And I'll say, well, what's fair? Can you define justice for me? Encomium means praise. That means you find something virtuous in the law or the narrative. Number nine is what you call invective or vituperation. And this is when you dog something. This is when you speak against something. And of course, by the time you get to sixth grade, your kids are probably going to really like that, when they start kind of, you know, getting moving into this the logic stage proper and they're kind of arguing with everybody. Well, they really love it when they can just blast somebody. You know, with fourth graders, blasting becomes, you know, don't do that. You know, no, don't go there. But it's true. Just don't do it. But anyway, so that's the thing that gets kind of fun in these writings. And of course, if you ever read any of Luther's commentaries, particularly like Galatians, you know, most of the stuff is invective against the Pope, who called him a wild boar in the Lord's vineyard. And so, you know, Luther goes through, you know, the just shall, you know, he'll go through any verse, and then it'll always be applied to the Pope, invective, and he'll just take his head off. It's wonderful invective. Go to Luther. Number 10, comparison, where you're comparing two things together. Great with Calvin. He was real logical, saying, you know, this is not this, and taking two things and showing how they're similar, how they're dissimilar. 11 gets into something which is more kind of like the early stages, but much broader, and it's personification or impersonation. It's a dramatic monologue, and you can picture somebody defending a law and taking on the role of a character and then proving his point to everybody with this personification. And when this is really what Jesus did with his parables. You know, the Pharisees would be out there dogging him, you know, chanting their little, you know, Jesus' disciples eat without unwashed hands, you know, or just whatever their little things are. They're chanting their little laws like that, little Pharisees. And then Jesus comes along and tells a story, and they're all engaged in the story. And then, hey, you know, he's talking about us. So Jesus would do that. And then 12 would be description, again, bringing a subject before eyes with a lot of graphic language and so forth. And then lastly, 13 and 14. 13, where it gets into where you have a thesis or an argument. It's a logical examination of the subject. And you can see why some of this is just not going to work with real young children. It's very complex. It'd be a challenge for most of us as adults. And then finally, the queen here, the culmination, is the introduction of the law, the forensic rhetoric, as they call this, legal rhetoric or legislation. And then it's the pros and cons of laws. I thought recently how much fun it would be to try to pass a law down our street. We have I don't know if you can call it an intersection, other than there's a bunch of multi-lane roads that all converge, and there's no stoplight. So we affectionately call it the Hail Mary intersection. You basically close your eyes, cross yourself, and say an Ave Maria and head on through there. And if you make it to the other side, then you offer a prayer of thanksgiving. It's amazing. I was thinking, now, this would be great, you know, to go in there and say, this is why this thing would be. And of course, somebody would immediately ad hominem you. You know, you're stupid. You got a law degree. What are you doing talking here? You know, it's like, well, doesn't it matter what I say? You know, why are you attacking me personally before I said anything? You know, ad hominem is the American model for discussion, debate, and argumentation. Just attack the person. Don't attack or try to show that what they're saying is wrong. So you have this law, you know, why we need a stoplight at this intersection. So you bring through all these things. You know, you tell a little fable or something like that, a little story. Once there was this family of bears, and there was this huge precipice off to the left-hand side of their den. Now, there was a history book written about the bear families that had lived there before, and all of the bears had fallen over that precipice. Everybody in the bear community knew about the precipice. Mom and Dad Bear knew about the precipice. When you see the precipice, remember, death, death, death. But Mom and Bear, Pa Bear, did nothing to instruct their children or make a rule about not going near the precipice. Okay, now that would be my little illustration of this intersection thing. You know, another way I say, okay, if you don't get that, I know that was real high-level thinking. You know, whoever makes a decision, get a stoplight up there. I mean, there's crashes all the time. So you can use this stuff. It's really wonderful for telling these little stories. I kind of storied you in the beginning to get you thinking about the grammar stage. Okay, some of these activities. The five-day approach. Here's the nuts and bolts of this stuff. Okay, now we're back up to step one. We're just going to start with a fable. And if you kind of just get a handle on this, if it's totally new to you, great. It's successful. If you're a little bit familiar with this, maybe you'll just get another little approach or twist to this. Teachers, though, we always need some kind of structure or something with which to work. And this would be what I'd call pro gym proper. This is actually where you're doing one of these exercises. I'm going to show you how this stuff needs to fit in with all the rest of the subjects. I mean, this is kind of what the grammar stage is about. But this is actually, if you're going to do one of these exercises, day one, you just get the kids familiar with the fable or the story. So I hand out a copy of the story. It's not theirs to keep. We read the story. Some kids read it. I read it. And then I'll often read other versions of the story. And it's amazing what you can find on the web in terms of stuff like this. I mean, I've got a little illustration here that we'll use with The Fox and Grapes by Aesop, the story you're all familiar with, and just all the versions that I found. And I actually found this website where people are trained to sketch, to make a drawing that goes, that illustrates a fable. And they study the particular fable in a Latin version, a Greek version, a French version. I mean, it's like they get this fable, it's like the fable is a diamond, and they look at every single little angle of the thing, and then they try to make a pencil sketch that illustrates the fable. I thought, this is incredible. I mean, I'm just a neophyte when I look at that kind of stuff. But if we just, you know, get something from these guys, it's great. So get some different copies of the story. Usually in the beginning of the year at the fourth grade level when they're still working on cursive and I'm trying to make a connection between the story, I'll go ahead and have them copy the little short story in cursive. Good exercise for kids. Usually not more than a page, usually just half a page. They copy it, hand that one in, and so forth. Day two, you're going to get them more familiar with the story, and then you're going to analyze the plot or the skeleton on this little analysis sheet. So on day two, you're kind of reading the story, having fun, talking about it, and then they get this. And you basically walk them through the particular fable. You ask them, and I call this the skeleton of the story. In other words, what's the basic building blocks? You don't want the kids just to memorize the fable word for word and retell it. You know, then they're, once upon a time, you know, they're like, you know, trying to memorize this thing, and it's totally awkward and strange. That's not how rhetoric is done. It's really primarily memory. That's where this thing fits in with what you've been taught about memorization in the lower school. Anyways, they get the story of it. Let's get, like, what are the three main things that happen here in this particular story? Let's just break it down, and I'll ask them to give me input. So we'll read the story, and they're kind of familiar with it at this point. I'll say, give me the short little preacher homiletical version of this. You know how preachers will do these things, you know, their three points will all start with P and all that kind of stuff. Well, we don't really do that. I kind of dissuade them to do that, actually. But they'll try to get kind of the first general point, the second one, the third one, and then kind of get it in their mind and so forth. And then what we'll do is we're just thinking, you know, we think through this quite a bit, and then we come down and we say, okay, first block, second block, third block of the story. We got this thing in our mind. We know what we need to know. And if you ever study storytelling, the minstrels and the storytellers, this is how they remember these long stories. They didn't remember all the details. They filled it in. They sketched it out for their particular audience, but they knew what the story was composed of. We call that the plot in literature class. Okay, then you're going to ask them, what are some good adjectives? You know, kind of integrate the Shirley grammar here with younger kids. And what are some exciting words that we find either in the story or we could use in the story? Some good verbs, maybe if you have vocabulary words. What are some vocabulary words that we can use here and so forth? And then other embellishments. What's something we could describe in detail? Well, we could describe the fox. We could talk about the grapes. We could describe how he tried to get the grapes and failed and all that kind of stuff. I'm just getting them to think about a narrative or a little fable. I'm training them in how to approach this, which is really educating. And then what part of the story could I expand and elaborate on? Now, when I do the fox and the grapes thing, I wish it was a little smaller group because I'd ask for a raise of hands. Which part of that story do you think they would expand? And of course, the basic story, there's a hungry fox, you know. Fox is hungry, sees grapes, tries to get grapes, fails, and then despises the grapes. You know, they were probably sour anyway. That story's not familiar to you. What do you think the kids love to expand on? Trying to get the grapes. Now, what'll happen is I'll kind of get, you know, like I'll ask them like that and, you know, kind of blank stares. And then I'll say, well, let me give you another little way. And so the fox went back and he got out a little mini rebounder that he'd purchased at Walmart. And then he ran and then he jumped. And now I just do that. I mean, the hands are going through the roof about the million different ways. And then someone says, you know, we have a rebounder at home. You know, Y'all laugh because that's the way education is. That's why, when you have those in your class, you always ask, comment about the story. And the hand goes down like that. Question about math. Hand goes down. Okay, so we're kind of just going through this thing, and then I teach them, just like, this is an art. I say, well, let's look at some of these stories. What are some of these famous opening lines? Once upon a time, one day, a long time ago in a faraway land. And you actually look through these stories, and you think, and this is what you teach musicians, if you're studying jazz or something, you say, now notice how guys start their little solo section. They do this little theme, and then they kind of hang for a minute, and then they sort of start to amplify it. Well, that's what you're doing here. You're saying, here's one of the tools. Now you be creative with it, and you pick your own little one. And then a closing sentence, which usually with a fable, it's just going to be concluding with the moral of the story. All right, well, that's a little sheet that I give them. It works for the fable, works for the fairy tale, works for a narrative. Then at the bottom I have, remember, description, use descriptive language, create pictures, some details and so forth, be specific. Now, it's interesting, when you ask most children to summarize something they've read, all they see is the details. And we don't help them with some of these fill-in-the-blank literature worksheets. What color was the horse that Joe rode on into the city? I don't know. Dappled pink? I can't remember. It doesn't have anything to do with the story. And so we kind of, we sort of focus on the details. In the beginning, your kids may be all detail stuff, and you're kind of, well, you're sort of missing the story. Well, you told a great thing about how the fox, tried to get the grapes, but you never said anything about how he spoke evilly of the, or poorly of the grapes. Those were sour anyways. Well, you kind of missed a major part of the story. So teach the kids the plot, but you do want to teach them some of the detailed language and then how to use dialogue with characters talking. And I've got a little sheet a little bit later on. I can give you some ideas for that. All right, that was really kind of just day two stuff. And once you're at this point, you've kind of done it for them. Because for the children, they've got the story. They've been thinking about language. They've been enjoying it immensely. You've been firing the imagination, getting them to think about some things. And by this point, they're almost ready to go. And then the next couple days, depending on what you can fit in the class, they're either ready to write their own little version, and it's done by memory, or they stand in front of the class and retell the story by memory. Now, some of you may be thinking, I don't think they could ever do that. Well, if they can memorize 5,000 history facts in fourth grade, they can memorize the basic components of a fable or fairy tale and retell it in their own language. And what's beautiful, you're going to find some children when you do this who you always thought were just the quiet, sort of reserved ones. Inside, there's this budding actress. And she gets up there and just the thing, it just explodes, and you'll just be sitting there with your mouth thinking, I had no idea that was inside of that little girl. She is just so creative. Now I know how to work with her a little bit better. Another thing that I do, back to the initial analysis, I may take a couple of vocabulary words that I want them to use in the story. And then we'll write down, usually it's a maximum of five. In the beginning of the year, I don't even include that just to make it as simple as possible. Just a little side note, whenever you teach kids English vocabulary, always connect it to stories. Don't make these little dictionary definition people. Like the kids with the photographic memories will get A's on all that stuff, but it won't do anything but get them a good SAT score in the, in the vocabulary section. You want to connect vocabulary with stories always, and this is a great way to do it. You don't have to test them on it. Just say you have to use these words, and we'll pick five good words, and sometimes they'll come up with words, or they'll say, we could use this vocabulary word that we learned in literature in this fable. And you sit back and think, that's a great idea. And I'm really seeing a lot of this stuff happen already in my fourth grade class where teachers are just getting a handle on a lot of really good things. When they come into my class, I just sit back and I'm thinking, I told my class this year, thank you for how you've blessed me. Because I actually have started to see some fruit of this education, and it gets so wonderful to see that. They'll use illustrations from history. One day, this fox was wandering through Carthage, Africa, and ran across this guy named Augustine who was out reading, and then he saw some grapes in the garden. Now Augustine, his father had a pear orchard, and they'll just start taking all this stuff, and then they'll stick in some little Latin phrase in there and pull out a vocabulary word, and it's really amazing, because this to me is what we're trying to do with the education. It's creative, it's verbal, it's artistic. So I'll use some vocabulary words as well. All right, in action, we're going to do the fox and the grapes. And they get a little sheet, and I teach them the little memory proverb. They just memorize it. It's easy to despise what you cannot get. It's easy to speak badly of things that you can't have. Sometimes when we can't get what we want, we pretend that we did not want it at all. Any fool can despise what he cannot get. So we talk about the moral of the fable. And then I read some stories. The fox and the grapes. And you teach the kids. Always start with the title, opening sentence, tell the story, close with the proverb or the moral. One hot summer's day, a fox was strolling through an orchard till he came to a bunch of grapes just ripening on a vine which had been trained over a lofty branch. "Just the thing to quench my thirst," quoth he. Drawing back a few paces, he took a run and a jump and just missed the bunch. Turning around again with a 1, 2, 3, he jumped up with no greater success. Again and again he tried after the tempting morsel, but at last had to give up. He walked away with his nose in the air, saying, "I'm sure they are sour." It's easy to despise what you cannot get. So they listen to it, and of course their faces are smiling. Here's another little different version. Now remember, just think about some vocabulary words that we might want to use when we retell this story. Here it is again, the fox and the grapes. A famished fox saw some clusters of ripe black grapes hanging from a trellised vine. And then I'll say something like, just curious, is there anything really interesting that this particular author described? Oh yeah, the grapes. Great. Yeah, isn't that wonderful? A famished fox saw some clusters of ripe black grapes hanging from a trellised vine. That makes my tummy grumble. Sounds wonderful. She resorted to all her tricks to get at them, but wearied herself in vain, for she could not reach them. At last, she turned away, hiding her disappointment and saying, "The grapes are sour and not ripe as I thought." Moral, it's easy to despise what you cannot get. So, you have some different versions of it. By this point, they'll probably say something like, "Well, why don't we use the word famished?" Or I'll say, "What does the word famished mean?" Someone will raise their hand. Let's get a definition. I write it up there. They write it down on their little analysis sheet. Famished, it means to be really, really, really hungry. Something like that. The kids will say, okay, to be really hungry. What's another one? Pick another word that maybe comes from one of the stories that we can use and so forth. And you're just kind of analyzing it, bringing in some vocabulary. There's some good dialogue here. They're getting ideas about what to describe. Now, in the beginning of the year, this is kind of slow going if your kids have not ever had anything like this. After a while, it just takes off, and really, I start to see the kids using this stuff in all of the rest of their classes. They really get a handle on it. They love it. They're story creatures created in God's image. All right, then we move on. Day 3, after we've kind of done some of that stuff, I'll have somebody stand up. We finish our Shirley Grammar. Okay, somebody stand up. Who'd like to tell us the story of the fox and the grapes? And I'll say, first one, just give me kind of a short skeletal version. And I'm holding them back from going crazy. Now, this is, thinking about, generally when you're trying to do writing-type exercise, verbal exercise, you get the, "I can't think of anything to write," to these kids, they're exploding with eagerness to do this stuff. So somebody stands up and they give us a real short version. We kind of think, okay, that was really good, and you kind of forgot this. Did you use all the vocabulary words? He forgot to use famished. Okay, let's try to use famished. It means really hungry. And then somebody else will stand up and tell the story. And then I get into some really fun things. I'll say, okay, Jean, you come on over here and you tell the first little section of the fable, and that's it. So he'll come over and he'll tell the little part, and I'll say, okay, great, go have a seat. All right, Ryan, you come up and take it over from where he left off. And then he'll come up in there and then he'll continue the story. And then I'll say, okay, stop right there. Charlie, you come up here and I want you to amplify the fox trying to jump and get the grapes. And of course, and they all, oh man, Charlie got the great one, So then he, and of course, I usually pick the kids that are a little bit more reserved. I give them those home runs. The other, there's another hand just, I was like, Charlie's going to do it. I'm going to sit down. So Charlie comes up and then he expands on that. I'll say, hey, Charlie, that's a great vocabulary word. And he said, yeah, I was thinking about, you know, the vocabulary we did, and I thought it would fit there. And so you're just kind of commenting on all this stuff, retelling it. Some of the classical rhetoric guys will also say the thing in reverse as well. Start with the end and go the other way. So you can see it's just causing them to think. Right, you're teaching them to think, the memory work's engaged, the creativity's flowing, although they didn't have to think of the story. All right, so they kind of do that. Perhaps, you know, maybe at this point where they've been some retells, I mean, they have this thing down, and maybe the next 2 days, if it's a written week where they're going to actually rewrite the story, let them use the time in class to rewrite the story. And in fourth grade, I really don't just hammer them over grammatical and spelling type stuff, because that just kind of kills, you know, the creativity. I mean, you want to come around and help them and try to apply some things and work toward integrating the grammar. It's like this, you know, you get a student that learns music and he learns how to write notes and all that kind of stuff, and then the first time he writes his own melody, you know, you're like, what kind of notation is this? Is this a new notation? So kind of go easy on them, I think. You know, the point of this is to inspire the retelling. So they'll either do it orally in front of the class, or they'll do a paper, or they'll do both. Some weeks, you know, it just all depends on what we're able to do with that class. Again, it's communication, orally and in written form. The classical writers and so forth, the guys that wrote on this historically, greatly emphasized verbal exercises at the lower stage. I think we maybe need to think about the amount of writing we have our kids do. I mean, that's a great thing, but writing is kind of, you know, it's maybe a little bit further on than we, you know, we really should be placing it at this point. We do so much with written stuff, and, you know, when kids have developmental struggles with writing and all that kind of stuff, and they're over there, and you ask them, you know, to, you know, your history test, you know, it was all essays. You know, I mean, it's like most college kids would sort of faint at it, and then you have them, they're writing all this stuff out. It becomes torturous. When you know you could sit down and say, tell me about this, and they could get it back to you verbally. So I think we need to do more verbal things, because really I see the primacy of the verbal, because when you write, what do? You hear a sentence in your head, and then you grammatically correct it. And hopefully if you've been trained verbally, you're putting your sentences together fairly well. And then you write that down, and voila, you have a story. Okay, that's the basic 5-day plan with the Pro Gym. By the way, just to hear a little embellished form of the Fox and Grapes, and I'll read something like this to them as well. I'll just read a little bit of it so you can get an idea. You know, the first part of the story, you know, hungry fox, sees some grapes, tries to get them, fails, and then despises the grapes. Here's just a little something. Once upon a time, a fox was walking through the forest. She was very hungry and thirsty because she had not had anything to eat or drink since the day before. The fox came to a glen in the forest where there were grapevines growing, but she was disappointed to see that almost all of the grapes had already been eaten by other animals. Then she looked up and saw one last bunch of grapes hanging from a vine that was looped high over the limb of a tree. Isn't that great descriptive language? I mean, you really see the picture in your mind. She could see that the grapes were big and fat and purple, and she knew from experience that they would be sweet and juicy, just the thing to quench her hunger and thirst. The fox jumped as high as she could, but the grapes were too high and she could not reach them. She tried to climb the tree, but the bark was too slick, and her paws were not well made for climbing. What image just came into your mind at that point? You saw it just trying to go up and just slipping and sliding down the bark of the tree. She jumped again, but she could not reach the grapes. The fox sat for a moment, looked up at the bunch of ripe grapes so far above her head. The thought of how those luscious fruit made her mouth water and her stomach growl, she wanted them very badly. And so, you know, you're just kind of inspiring them to think about how they can do these things with these little illustrations. Okay. Couple little pointers when they actually come to write or compose things. Some of the main problems they have, I just kind of boil this down. Start a sentence with a capital letter. Surely grammar. A sentence, sentences, complete. Run on sentences, just stringing everything together. don't know when to begin a new paragraph, indentations or page setup, spelling, misspelling basic words, shows you what you need to focus on in your spelling, not doing proper titles, quotations or dialogue, then what I call explanatory words, and then multiple items. He bought apples, oranges, and bananas, that kind of stuff they have a little difficulty with. I'll kind of slide that over if you're trying to write some of that stuff down. Maybe you can catch this next thing. They love, when they're working with quotations on explanatory words, Jim answered, da-da-da-da, he said, quote the fox, just different. You're giving them little tools to write well when they're doing quotations with these various things. Different kinds of sentences drawn from Shirley Grammar. If you got a declarative sentence, you can use all these different things. One day we had a great little exercise. We were reading through a book and we said, let's just look at all of the explanatory words that are used by the author, and then we wrote them down and they came up with all these. He yelled, he shouted. The average American kid, when they describe something, and then he goes like, you know, and they don't even say anything. And then she goes, and then he goes, and then they come the next day and say, Mr. Smith, we were riding home with my mom, and she was telling us something, and guess what? She kept saying, he goes, she goes, he goes, she goes. I said, well, go easy on mom. We're trying to educate her as well. Alright, when I'm grading some things, the basic things at this stage, do they state the title of the story? Decent opening sentence? Do they get the skeleton of the story? They've got some vocabulary used. And then just some kind of comments about their creativity, their embellishment, so forth. Closing sentences, and then that they state the main proverb again. All right. Now, you basically do the same thing when you do fairy tales and other narratives. You can use Bible parables, narratives from history. You can use anything with the Pro Gym. I'm just going to skip down just to one last thing and close. I know we're about out here, or we are out. The last little section on integrating some of this stuff. Because if you're getting overwhelmed thinking, I don't have time for another subject that's probably going to take 15 to 30 minutes every day. Just to remind you again, this is number 4, Roman numeral 4, integration activities. Just remember, think about the priority of oral activities when we're at the grammar level. Get the kids talking and expressing. Letter B, you know, with some different things. When you've taught the kids a principle or you're reviewing something, ask somebody to explain it to you. Tell me how to do this and let them put it in their own words. Great thing. With literature, I've gone to using praises, which are chapter summaries, much more than fill-in-the-blank worksheets. So what we do is when we're going through literature books, we read a chapter together as a class. They have a notebook, and then they write their own summaries. And basically, all this stuff is going together. It's much more profitable. I can go through a book in fourth grade like Rolf and the Viking Bow, which has a very complex plot, and they love it because they've been taught how to walk through the plot with their chapter summaries. And they, the next day, a few kids read them. It's a rhetorical exercise. And then they get really crafty and artistic with the writing of their praises. In literature, you can do character sketches describing a character. And then the dreaded book report, which kids usually hate. I do 2 a year. One is due in the beginning of December, one in the beginning of May. And by the time we've done praises, rhetorical exercises, all of this, and I tell them how to walk through to do the analysis of a book, they love book reports. They absolutely love them. Rather than read some book that you want to and write a paper on it, you know, totally vague, I walk through and I say, summarize the story, tell me your favorite part, and they use all these rhetorical exercises and they love it. In history, a great way to do some things is to summarize the cards. After we've done all the little fact thing, you know, who was Augustine's mother? Monica. What year was Augustine born? What year was he converted? All that stuff. I'll ask somebody, tell me what you know about Augustine. And then they'll have to put together complete sentences and retell that. Great way to do history. When you're teaching history, I strongly encourage you finding more historical stories to use rather than all the dry fact stuff. Bring it to life. There are great books, the Children's History of the World and so forth, that have got tons of stories. I teach medieval and Renaissance and Reformation, so I've got Church History 101, all these great stories, and the kids just sit on the edge of their seats while I tell them the stories. And then they interact, and I have kids tell me, well, you know, what happened with Alfred when such and such happened. They like to do that. grammar, working on some dictations and sentences. Bible, again, I approach Bible the same way with literature, with the praises, character sketches. Do a lot of recitations of poetry. That's the equivalent of a child learning a musical piece and playing it back by memory rather than writing or creating something. Have them recite poetry. If you do the catechism, great way to do it, Proverbs. And then get some tapes where they can listen to some of these fables and fairy tales read on tape. I have found some tremendous narrators. I mean, they just keep you on the edge of the seat. Now, I'll do that so they can just hear the story, but I'll say, now listen to what she did with the characters. I found a guy who did Oliver Twist, and he was one of these English Shakespearean actors. And I mean, he is so engaging with his voices and so forth, and the differences between narration sections and dialogue, tremendous. And I'll call attention to that with my kids. Notice what he did there. That's a tremendous, tremendous bunch of grapes, said the fox. Where you make that differentiation. They'll mimic that stuff as well. Get them listening, doing some poetry. In my Latin class, I'm trying to read more Latin from Jerome's Vulgate rather than just all this chanting and repetition of vocabulary. I want them to fall in love with Gloria Patri, et Filio, et Spiritui Sancti, sicut erat in principio, et nunc, et semper, et in saecula saeculorum. And I'll say, doesn't that feel great coming off of your tongue? And they'll kind of look at me. You're scary. Get them to fall. That's how they actually taught Latin. They didn't start off with just chanting stuff and all that. Just get them reading it and then integrate it together. And then, of course, the minstrel is kind of the culmination of that. And then if our schools can get involved in more dramas and plays, be a wonderful thing. Okay, I've got to quit there. Sorry I didn't get to spend more on some of these other things. Let's go ahead and pray, and we'll be done. Father, thank you for this time, and thank you, Lord, for the beautiful way that you communicate with us. Not only the things that you say in your word, but the way that you've said them, the beautiful poetry, metaphor, analogy. Thank you that you have created us in your image and given us a great desire to do this. And I pray you'd help us to apply this to the grammar school instruction, whether it's kindergarten or first grade or all the way through the education. May this be a pleasant and a fruitful task for every one of us. And I pray that you just stir us up to study the great importance of these basic rhetorical exercises and how they apply. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen.